द्वैताद्वैत महामोह सर्वरीक्षपण क्षम भास्वानिव जयते को गणेशो दूतरीयुत प्रतिभायाः परोल्लासो निशाकर इवापरः दूतीयुक्तः स जयतु वटुकस्ताण्डवान्वितः ॐ शान्तिः शान्तिः शान्तिः। So today we'll discuss about the group meditation in cross-cultural context. I'll tell you a few stories from few cultures. And it's very, very well known historical fact of Southeast Asia. There was a king whose ancestors had migrated from India to Thailand, and then from there they spread in different parts of Southeast Asia. Jayaditya Varma, very famous name of that king. His ancestors had migrated from east coast of India, famous place Bhuvaneswar and Jagannath Puri. So they established their kingdom in Southeast Asia, and in fact their kingdom in different stages in their dynasty. It was all over Southeast Asia, including all the way into the deep into the jungles of Borneo, Java, Sumatra. And there have been even the names even today in the far, far, far deep into the jungles, even touching almost much closer to Australia. There are the places they established, and later on that were taken over by the jungles. When the Sanskrit names are there, so the whole name is Jaya, for example. It was because of Jayaditya Varma. Even certain kind of rice, which is still the most best rice, even best means really best. Once you eat that rice, you will have no taste for so-called modern, this popular basmati rice. It's called Jaya rice. That is the celebrity rice even today in South India. And so that is Jayaditya Varma. So he held a very, very, very big group practice. And but according to the culture which he had inherited from India and had popularized in Southeast Asia, the objective of that group meditation was that he will go to heaven after death. And not just simply he will go to heaven, but rather he will have the status of Indra. Who is king of gods. He will live a celestial realm called Amaravati. Amaravati, where the Amaras, where the immortal ones live. Amaravati. And upon completing that guru practice which he had sponsored and had funded, he got the title of Mahendra, the great Indra. If you ever read the history of, you know, Southeast Asia, you will find all these things. This story I'm telling you, Mahendra. Mahendra is a title. It's made up two words, Maha and Indra. So that's how it becomes Mahendra, the great Indra. While it means the living God in flesh, you know. Whatever was the outcome of it, history could not preserve it. Had it been really that significant on earthly plane, at least history could have remembered it for a relatively long period of time. Although in our world where life change is immutable law, you know, in that kind of world where we live today, in this world, nothing lasts forever, but at least, you know, see here, Abraham Lincoln, Mahatma Gandhi, very many other people, their legacy has lasted for a while. It did not last. Similarly, another place I have visited, where I heard another amazing story. Story is from Burma, most central Burma, probably central part of Burma, where I saw an amazing temple. It was a temple city, many, many temples. I saw an amazing temple in which, in central chamber, there was a very gigantic reclining Buddha statue of reclining Buddha. Extremely sad looking Buddha. It's like crying. And then now when I went around the temple, in every niche there was Buddha statue. In every niche, very sad face, you could see expression of guilt, expression of sorrow, expression of grief, you know. It was very unusual to see. That was a place where there is another amazing story. Another king, who was the king of that particular area, had funded very, very big group practice. And he was known for his piety, good actions. So one day in his assembly, in his court, there came a very erudite pandit, scholar. And he presented himself with demonstration of and demonstrated his knowledge, wisdom. And in those days, a warrior challenging another warrior, a scholar challenging another scholar in debate was common phenomena. So he challenged the scholars, pundits of this particular kingdom in debate. And all the scholars, local scholars of this kingdom, they lost the debate. The king was very much impressed with this scholar. Asked him that, where did he learn all this? Where did he gain all this knowledge? So he told him that it is from such and such scripture, it is such and such philosophy. And he showed even one of the scriptures, his favorite scripture, which he was carrying. And so in the course of conversation, this scholar told the king that this scholar's king, in his scholar's king's kingdom, there are thousands of such scriptures. The library of his king in his kingdom is filled with thousands of such scriptures. So this king wrote a note to the king and gave that letter to this scholar and ordered him to go and tell the king that he must surrender all those books, scriptures to this king, because this king is the most superior king on the planet. Now it became a matter of honor, because this king is ordering other king. Therefore, the other king, with all those books, felt very insulted. So he wrote back, if you are that much interested in the books, better you come and retrieve it in the battlefield. Get it from me in the battlefield. So thus there was war. Of course, this king here was much more powerful, went and defeated the king, arrested the king and all his courtiers, all of his kinsmen, and captured all the books, and brought back not the books, just only the books, but rather the king and his family, all the courtiers, all the ministers, everyone, he brought them to his kingdom and said, now you are my subject. You people are my subject. Now here comes his so-called novel virtues that he had, quote, gathered through his all great, great deeds, including the spiritual deeds of this group meditation which he had performed in the past. So he was supposed to be very kind. He was supposed to be very person of very, very high standards and higher values. So he demanded, he told the king that in my kingdom, no one is struggling and suffering. Therefore, tell me, what do you wish to have? Anything that you need will be provided in my kingdom, including, if you wish, I'll give my entire kingdom to you. No, I don't. So this king was also very proud of his status. Said, no, I will live here as your subject. Give me simply enough land where I can build my palace. And I do not need any financial support. I have plenty of that wealth I have brought with me, which you have not claimed. So he built his kingdom, though he built his palace. In addition to the palace, he built this temple complex in which he installed Buddha. In retaliation of Buddha's behavior, that how come Buddha did not, did not come forward and help me? He's known for his compassion. He is known for his, all-knowing power, omniscience. This is the Buddha. That's what you are, Mr. Buddha. To really express his anger, displeasure with Buddha, he installed such statues of Buddha that Buddha will come to know how it feels to be living as somebody else's slave. I'm going to. So that's how even the the vantage point from where you take a glance of Buddha, it's all prison looking, you know, bars are there. You know? Really, it looks like. And even when you go there, it is designed, the passage is designed in a manner that not more than one person can go, and even that person has to go like this, you know, because there is not enough room. So see here, this kind of great, great, great spiritual practice was performed, which according to that culture, it was something superb. Now imagine, in our modern times, will it be appropriate to do such things? Perhaps in those days it could have been just fine. There wasn't much movement from one place to another place. Only very small group of, a small number of people living in different parts of the world knew enough about other parts of the world. Enough, and definitely the speed at which today we communicate, we share the ideas, learn from each other, teach each other. Definitely, things were not happening at that speed in those days. So Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, Jews, believers, non-believers, could live in their world and do things which, according to their community, society, culture, was supposed to be having a great spiritual merit. In today's world, it doesn't happen anymore. Today we are living in the era of social media. You know, you do something here and it's all over the world. No. And the kind of socio-political culture we have created, people have right, people have opportunity to ask questions, and people expect that they will receive some response, some answer. The lack of response, lack of answer, that itself will go in social media. So both what you express through words and what you express through your silence, both of them circulate throughout the planet. So what we do in our good conscience, in our ill conscience, what we do rightly and what we do incorrectly, both are very much known to the whole world. Even people have now much more greater opportunity and tools and means to know whether our intentions are really that pure. We cannot fake it so easily. No? And let alone the fact that we can't fake our own, we can't fake ourselves. We can't, you know, lie to our own conscience. Our conscience is right there. But let's say, even if you are wanting to, trying to carry a mask, even the mask, people, there is now, we are living in a world today where we have ability to see right through the mask. No? That's the world we are living. So definitely, many of such group practices, whether they held any true, whether they held any real merit or they did not hold any such merit. Still, they are no longer really that applicable. So what kind of group practice is applicable today? That's what I will discuss with you. In this regard, I will raise another important question here. That any group practice in worldly sense requires two things. Number one, actual human participation. Okay. And number two, some financial worldly resources. And these two things are not really that hard. They are not very easy either, but they are not that hard either, no? Compared to how people participate in bad things so easily, so fast. Participation in meditative, peaceful practices is definitely harder. It's much more harder to undertake and execute a peaceful project than undertaking and executing unpeaceful, violent, destructive, negative projects. Why is that? We have been discussing many, many times. We have raised this question and have tried to address it. So this is the reality. And yet, there is another fact which is much more important in addition to the actual human participation and material means, money, funding, etc. Even more important, these two factors is our commitment and our intention behind any such group practice, group meditation. And in this regard, even though we have discussed this matter, this point before, and yet it is important to remember again, is how clear is our intention and how focused is our intention. These two factors really make a big difference. Each time when some bad things happen, for example, we get up and we protest bad things. But such protests have really not done that great magic we expected. More than 1 billion people protested the war in the Middle East. And yet, billion people together could not stop it. There are more than 100,000 people in the streets of London City protesting war. First day. By the end of the day, number declined. After lunch, number declined by 20-30%. Next day declined by 50%. Following day declined by another 10-20%. By third day, whole movement was finished. Why? If 1 billion people really didn't wish not to do something, is it possible that they will not be able to accomplish it? So there is lack of will. And in our modern times, people talk about political will as though a political will is the only option. So we don't have, there is a lack of political will since we are talking about meditation, group meditation. that word, so-called that word political will, doesn't apply. It has to be human will. Okay? It has to be the will of our inner self that has to really come forward. And it has to be very clear. It has to be very united. And clarity here means the clarity of our goal and objective, as well as tools and means that we are using. Both. So that degree of clarity. And then comes the focus. Anytime, anywhere, in any manner, using any kind of voice, using any kind of tools, somebody is using loud voice, somebody is being quiet, somebody is using silent voice, somebody is being mentally participating, somebody is verbally participating, somebody is participating in some kind of action-driven manner. So hodgepodge. That doesn't work. So take another example. This big Woodstock event, which we just celebrated, I think commemorated 50th anniversary of Woodstock. Even though the actions were not, the delivery of execution of Woodstock was not super concentrated, and yet intention was somehow quite on the same wavelength. There were artists, musicians, people from all different walks of life. No, they came there. And hardly anybody knew what was going to happen and what were they doing. And yet intention was, let us do something positive. No? Something good. And everybody was kind of fed up and tired. Tired of, fed up with destructive, violent, actions out there. Result? It had impact. It had impact. Less than 1% of the people, those who participated in Woodstock phenomena in those days, are alive. And if they are alive, then very many of them are not in the position anymore to go and really do all those things which they did in 1969. And still, the legacy continues. People still remember it. Still there is you go and see, it's just a big, big farmland, grassland, where this event was held. And still people talk about it as though if the land has become sanctified. Why? Because they came from very, very pure place, deep in their own heart. Their intentions were correct, very pure. And they spent 3 days. And they really didn't care whether it was raining and whether they had enough food or they did not have enough food. They just camped right there. Whereas in London, when they were protesting the war, after a few hours of the protest, they were concerned about where to go and have our lunch. They were looking at their apps, And they were very, very worried that this big crowd suddenly, The city is flooded with this big crowd. All the restaurants, all the fast food places, and all the pubs, they're completely overburdened. And people were concerned about that. Therefore, their own goodness of their heart was, at least in part, was captured, kind of subdued by their immediate needs. People, those who are in Woodstock, you just ask them, where did you go to the bathroom? I'm not saying that, you know, you start a big, big, wonderful, you know, heart-driven project and you just start peeing everywhere. I'm not saying that. But look at the spirit behind it. Thank God in those days, I think 50 years ago, this kind of, you know, under-civilized behaviors were not as so-called strictly frowned upon as they are now. That is totally different issue, but the thing is, how did they manage their food? How did they manage their toilet? How did they sleep? And when it started raining, that story is there. It rained. Everybody was wet, soaked. No? And they lasted for 3 days. And not only they lasted, in that short period of time, 72 hours time, 3 days time, the bonding that was created, that bonding lasted for a long, long time. So many great musicians came out of that. This just suddenly emerged. Artists started helping other artists. Philosophers started, you know, communicating with other philosophers. That's called group meditation. That's called a group practice. Okay. Had it been a little bit more structured, organized, well thought out, and a little bit more planning, I guarantee it could have made a million times greater impact than any, you know, Olympics in the world. Has any Olympics really made that kind of impact as Woodstock has made? Despite how, quote, uncomfortable, no, it was, that is the spirit behind a group practice. So here at the Institute, what kind of group practice are we planning? Are we doing? It is very, very well thought out group practice. It's very, what you call, pointed, focused intention, which you can, for the sake of explanation, presentation, you can divide in 4 or 5 parts. One, it is for calming violence. When I talk about violence, once in a while, I hear, are you really concerned that things are really going to take a bad turn? It's not a matter of they will or they will not. Whatever is obvious. No, it's obvious. We do not have such a wonderful, remarkable society where we can walk without any fear. Whatever amount of violence we have, that is good enough for us to talk about how to overcome that violence, calm down that violence, but not as a reaction. Each time when a shooting happens, everybody starts talking about gun control. No. And everybody starts blaming lawmakers. People start blaming. Well, NRA, isn't that? National Rifles Association. But how short-lived is that spirit? When such things happen, right on the spot, if it is 18 months away from the general elections, our political system doesn't care for all those quote noises. If it is hardly 1 year away, 6 months away, then it becomes one of particular parties' election agenda. Is it the reason that we should have more control over the gun or not control, or don't have any control over the gun? Is it the reason because elections are on the way? Or is some other reason? Therefore, the reason itself is faulty. Just because 10, 20 people died and that is the reason that we should have this discussion? Is it something, such a new circumstance? It did not happen, it didn't exist before, and do you think it will not exist in future? People don't think that far. It is a reaction. It is driven by reaction, and people fall in that so-called sympathy phenomena. And definitely it is not a bad thing. It is human phenomena, of course. There is pain, there is sorrow, there is anger, there is violence. It is to be addressed. But sustainability comes when there is a greater understanding of that particular situation and its short-term as well as long-term impact on individuals as well as on the society. Since these things are not that well thought out and it is not coming out from a calm and peaceful, tranquil mind, but rather it is such agendas, such conversations, such dialogues are emerging from a disturbed, angry mind. Therefore, the outcome is not going to be something very peaceful, and the outcome will not be anything free from all controversies. That is the point I am making here. And therefore, the practice that we are doing is not necessarily so-called coming down a particular type of violence there, but rather to eradicate the very cause of violence. A restless mind, a mind that is drowning in confusion, anger, hatred, jealousy, greed, divisive behaviors, that mind is bound to manufacture unrest in the external world. It is a very sophisticated principle. And of course, I understand, as a philosopher, I understand the ground level reality that people will, definitely people will say, oh, this philosopher talks, you know, in abstract language. But this kind of so-called abstract language deserves some attention and has some merit. Quite often, people do not pay attention to that. We are spiritually driven sadhakas, aspirants. Somewhere, at least, some of us, few of us, have gotten the taste of a relatively calm and tranquil mind. We have gotten a first-hand experience that how a calm and tranquil, peaceful mind acts and behaves. And if that kind of calm and tranquil mind is nurtured, taken to the next level of its, and taken to the next level, then definitely that kind of mind and the people, those who have that kind of mind, can do great wonders. It is in this context I'm talking about the purpose behind this group meditation that I'm talking, you know, this institute has undertaken. It is to calm the violence. It's not to blame, not to criticize those who are suffering, those who are on the suffering end of the violence, or those who are committing the violence. Okay. I'm talking about the phenomena of violence itself. So number one. Number two, poverty elevation. There is poverty out there. We are good at pointing our fingers on others that there is poverty in South America, there is poverty in India, there is poverty in China, there is poverty in such and such part of the world, as though if there is no poverty right next to our own community somewhere or in our own neighborhood. There is poverty. Here standards of living in the United States of America is different from many, many other countries. Here our social structure is different, our expectations are different, and therefore in a society where there are 11% people below the poverty level, what does it mean? 10% of 350 is 35 million people. And recently, what I'm hearing is this so-called poverty level in this country has reached somewhere close to 14%. Close to 14%. So add 10, 15 more million, almost 44 million people in this country are struggling. And their struggle is as intense as those so-called, those who make less than $2 in other countries. We make fun of countries where average person makes only $2 or less. And in that context, we think of that we are in much better position. No. And that is not the case. Here, if you don't have car, you are almost crippled fellow. You can't go and buy your grocery because it is, you know, in many, many cases, in except in big cities, expenses are high, where you can walk and buy your grocery, but still it's hard. But in the villages, in smaller towns, it's many, many miles away, and only means that you can have is the way our society is designed. You have to have car, then you have to have insurance. You have to have car insurance, health insurance, this, that. And it turns out that you are, if you have less than $30,000-$40,000, you are very poor. And then on top of that, there is a humiliation element. Many, many generations go by. No, poverty just continues. In other countries, 40% of the children-related diseases in India are due to the malnutrition. Okay? 50% of children whose growth is stunted because of the malnutrition, they are in India, whereas the GDP growth of India is remarkable. Everybody is rushing to India, talking about India, talking about, you know, foreign direct investment and all those things. Okay? Similarly, still, just you know, despite all this growth and things, is still somewhere close to 250 million people every day in China. Are they are called floating population from one construction site to another construction site, and they are the one who occupy, you know, the train systems of China. The point is here, there is poverty. 1 billion people in the world are struggling, and they go to bed sometimes with very little, sometimes even with no food, sometimes with very little food in their tummy. I consider them like those, each and every such people. There are at least 1 billion people. They are like small. Grief, anger, sorrow, manufacturing factories. There are many factories from their mind, from their heart, from their consciousness. That pain is oozing out, filling the sky. And it is from there, it's circulating the whole planet. We are here, lucky. We are not hungry. We seem to be more fortunate than very many other people, and yet we are sharing that space, that sky, the air, the wind, which is carrying the traces of that subtle sorrow and pain, you know, that is being manufactured from the minds and hearts and the bodies and senses of 1 billion people. So this group meditation is to calm down, alleviate that poverty and the pain and sorrow that arises from that. Then comes racial conflicts and differences. It's almost everywhere this is catching on. In the middle of the century, this is what we were so determined. Let's wipe out. Let's rise above. We have created enough pain for ourselves and for our fellow beings throughout the planet. Let's overcome this tendency. Hardly 50 years later, 70 years later, we are getting into the same very thing which we wanted to get rid of. And you look at the history, quite often yogis do not read newspaper and things. But I do it so that I can stay connected to the truth, so that I don't put my own philosophy and my own so-called practice of positivity in wrong context. I can live in the cocoon of my own so-called positive philosophy and become disconnected from the rest of the world. But I know it. Sooner or later, when reality will reveal itself to me, I will regret, you know. My own conscience will tell me that I did not do what I could have very easily done, and therefore I have failed in recognizing my dharma and sticking to my dharma. So for that reason, for my own spiritual growth, and for the growth and the development of the higher virtues of my own heart, I read these things which seem to be quite politically contaminated. I use these so-called contaminated news to further purify my own mind and heart. It is like a caustic soda you use in your soaps. So I use these caustic kind of news and information and turn into a nice washing agents to cleanse my own mind. So the purpose of this group meditation is to help human consciousness understand that there is pain and sorrow, and at least in part that pain and sorrow is caused by poverty. And this poverty is very real poverty. And as long as this poverty exists, many of our suffering fellow beings will not have much time and energy to really understand anything about their inner poverty and anything about the need for reclaiming their inner prosperity. Therefore, this group meditation, the purpose of this group meditation is to tap into that collective consciousness, which opens our eyes, which opens our minds and hearts, and enables us to see what is happening in the external world and how painful it is, how to have a real feeling of that, and how to get inspired to do something in a positive way so that we as one, we as integral part of one life force, find ourselves contributing to the elevation of that external poverty so that we have enough intelligence left, enough knowledge, enough wisdom, enough will is left for understanding about inner poverty and the removal of inner poverty and replacing it with inner prosperity. That was point three. Point four. Rejuvenating our natural world. We are in bad shape. We can no longer live in denial that no, everything is just fine and divine. No, it's not fine and divine. How many people in the world can afford to just live on oxygen tanks? And is it really such a sign of our prosperity and achievement and development that our air is polluted and we just start, you know, canning fresh air? We have already done enough for water. Next thing is, go to the vending machines where you can inhale some good nice air. Pay a couple of bucks and move on. Reach the next place. No, pay digitally. That is not the way to live. Soil. We talk about organic food. When there is no organic mind left anymore, when there is organic heart left anymore, when there is no organic air, when there is no organic water, where do you find organic soil to grow organic food? Of course, it is definitely, you know, good idea to have as good healthy organic food as possible. But the point is, whole atmosphere has been disrupted. We are living in a very, very imbalanced world. The purpose of this group meditation is again to awaken the intelligence in our collective consciousness whereby we can understand the importance of proactively doing something to nourish our environment, restore its vitality, and do something for ourselves, do something for the planet, and do something for the rest of the generations to come. That was number four. Number five is just this understanding that everything begins with our own mind. Because all these four different points and their goals and objectives that we are talking about, it is possible only when we as an individual are really grounded in our own inner self. When our basic understanding of life is correct, and when we begin to live in the body, which is healthy, mind, which is healthy, senses, which is healthy, then it is with that healthy body, healthy mind, healthy senses, we become a healthy individual. As a healthy individual, will have an opportunity to create and maintain a healthy family, healthy society. Therefore, the idea of our personal unfoldment is on the top priority. Society is made of individuals. We are not separate from the society. Society is not separate from us. Change always begins with us, the individuals. When one individual is inspired, somehow that individual is able to emit the kind of energy which he or she embodies. Other people become inspired, then suddenly whole family becomes inspired, society becomes inspired, community becomes inspired. It may take 1 year, it may take 10 years, it may take 100 years. In large scheme of things, the 100 years is not a big thing. For last 1,000 years, just as 1,000 years in the past has gone by, similarly, next 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years will go by too. If we do not start doing something in much bigger context today, then it will never get done tomorrow. And it always has to begin with one individual. And when 5,000, I just saw today before coming to this session, I was looking at our tracker, meditation tracker, year-long meditation tracker. It's 5,400. That means 5,400 people plus are meditating with one intention. And none of them have been manipulated into meditating. They are inspired by themselves. They know what they are doing. And they are doing it by themselves. They have been able to hear and heed the voice of their own heart. They have vision, they have insight, they have courage to heed the voice of their heart. And number is rising every day. Just imagine if you have 10,000 people, 20,000 people meditating with right intention, with right attitude, for right reason. And if they are free from all kinds of isms, if they are able to identify themselves that they are human beings, and they happen to be Christian, Muslims, Hindus, or anything else, only because they happen to be human beings in the first place. It's very, very difficult to, I don't think that we can really imagine many other creatures in the world to be so-called a staunch follower of any religion. We are human beings. We are mild followers of a particular religion. We are strong followers of a particular religion. We are not followers of any religion. All these things are possible for us only because we are human beings and we embody an amazing kind of body, mind, senses, philosophy, ideology. As long as this fundamental characteristics, which is common to all of us, which is humanness itself, if we acknowledge that, respect that, nurture that, share that, then we can create a community society that will have vision to really see, wow, what a great gift we have gotten from our ancient ones, our ancestors and our forefathers, fathers, mother, that I inherited Christianity. Wow, how lucky I am. I inherited Islam. How lucky I am. Because we will know how profound these things are. We'll also know that with the passage of time, some unnecessary things have also entered this lofty heritage. We'll have courage to distinguish a great gem from useless clutter. And in the process of distinguishing right from wrong, healthy from unhealthy, we'll not have any guilt at all because we know that we are doing the right thing. We are giving the best of Christianity and Hinduism, Islam, Judaism to our children and to ourselves. We'll find a totally different level of self-respect for ourselves. Okay. So this particular group practice that I'm talking about, which we are holding here, is exactly for being able to reclaim that purity of our mind and higher concentration of purity of our heart, concentration of our own mind, clarity of our own intellect, so that we are able to hear the voice of our own conscience, so that we are able to walk in the light of our own conscience, and while walking in the light of our own conscience, so that we are able to discover best of the gift that nature has given us, our society has given us, our religion has given us, great line of philosophers and thinkers have given us, and thus we can create a beautiful world, first in our own personal life, then in our much bigger collective life. What kind of practice is this? Super, super, super simple. Just simply sit down, be with yourself. Being with yourself means turn your mind inward and let you follow the peaceful flow of your mind inwardly. Where your own peaceful inward flow of mind takes you, just simply let you know later. Definitely, a peaceful mind cannot take you to a dangerous place at all. Only an unpeaceful mind, violent mind, angry mind, fearful mind can take you to a place which is full of fear, full of danger. Okay? This is very simple law of life. A peaceful mind will lead you to a peaceful place. An unpeaceful mind will lead you to the unpeaceful place. A mind which is accompanied by anger, doubt, fear, grief, and sorrow cannot take you to a place which it does not know where it is and what it is. Angry mind knows anger, fearful mind knows fear. A peaceful mind knows peaceful peace, peaceful place. A loving and kind mind knows about love and kindness. That is why this particular practice I'm talking about is for cultivating that, connecting to ourselves to that pure and clear conscience and walk in the light of that conscience. While walking in the light of the conscience, we reach a very safe place. while living in that safety of that, our inner conscience, then we start discovering the best of the gifts that is inside us and best of the gifts that are outside us. And from thereafter, our inner quest as well as our outer quest, they both become very, very wonderful quests. Thank you. God bless you all.